Mr. Kelly, go ahead and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you all for your indefatigable consideration of this matter. My name is Robert Kelly. I am appearing in my capacity as General Counsel for Convention of States Action. We are a nationwide grassroots nonprofit organization that has over 3 million supporters across this country, many of whom call the great state of Idaho their home. I will keep my remarks brief because I know you all need to be up on the floor. What I essentially want to do is boil this down to the core issue that the country is facing here today. The core problem in American politics today is a crisis of federalism. The simple reality is that the balance of power has been thrown off between the states and the federal government. Now, our Constitution had protections to ensure that there would be retained that balance of power. And those protections were predominantly the Senate of the United States, which was elected by the state legislatures until the adoption of the 17th Amendment, and, of course, the provision in Article 5 that gives the states co-equal power with Congress to propose amendments to the Constitution. Well, since the adoption of the 17th Amendment, the states cannot rely on the Senate to be a bulwark for them that they operated in before. And since the states have never shown any willingness to use the Article 5 process through to its conclusion, that, too, has not put any check on the federal government. And, of course, the result of that, the result of not using the constitutional checks that are in our system to rein the federal government in, is exactly what we have today. We have a federal government that has run amok. And that is essentially what this legislation is trying to address. It is trying to use that remaining constitutional check that exists in the Constitution to put the states back at the table and to show the federal government that the states mean business and that it needs to show the proper respect to them as the sovereign entities that they are. I want to briefly address a couple of points that were brought up in the questions from this committee and in the arguments that were brought up. The first of those is just this simple idea that we do not know what would happen at an Article 5 convention. That is patently false. If you look at the text of Article 5, it says that Congress, on the application of the legislatures of two-thirds of the several states, shall call a convention. Shall means must. It has to call the convention. And once the convention convenes, that has to be ratified by three-fourths of the several states. Article 5 says the only power that a convention has under Article 5 is to propose amendments. That is all this legislation establishes. It establishes an interstate drafting body. So any idea that this is going to go crazy, do something ridiculous, doesn't matter because all of those proposals have to come back to the states to be ratified. Interestingly, there's been a lot of questions about whether the states will have one state, one vote at the convention. Again, this is actually in the text of Article 5. Okay, in the text of Article 5, it says that ratification is by three-fourths of the states. So even if California gets 100 votes at the convention, and even if Idaho gets one vote at the convention, any proposal has to come out and has to be ratified by the states voting as states. 38 states, in fact, which is an incredibly high bar. So anything drafted at the convention will have to be drafted, keeping in mind that ratification is going to be on a one-state, one-vote basis. So even if the convention goes completely bonkers and California gets 100 votes and proposes something wacko, the states are still going to have to ratify. Nothing bad will come out of this process. The other piece of this I would encourage the committee to consider is the importance of historical precedent in actually interpreting the Constitution. Just to give an obvious example of this, consider the phrase innocent until proven guilty. You all have a constitutional right in a criminal trial to be innocent until proven guilty. But that phrase nowhere appears in the Constitution of the United States. It comes to us from the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment and from the jury process that's laid out in the Sixth Amendment. But the phrase innocent until proven guilty does not appear there. How do we know you have that constitutional right? Because the founders held numerous jury trials. It was very clear what it meant, due process of law, what a speedy and impartial jury trial meant to them. And that's why you can be absolutely assured that if you face a criminal trial today, you will be treated as innocent until proven guilty. The same principle applies to the interpretation of Article 5. There have been 36 multi-state conventions in American history, at least 36. We have records from 36 multi-state conventions in American history. At every single one of those conventions, the states voted on a one-state, one-vote basis. There has never been a deviation from that rule. Many of those conventions were limited as to the topic that the states considered. The states had authority to limit the topics that their delegates could consider. Also important to note is that the states were the ones appointing the delegates. Under no circumstances was Congress the body appointing the delegates. Another interesting point is that 11 of those 36 conventions took place in the decade from 1776 to 1787. That's the decade between the Declaration of Independence and the adoption of the Constitution. I think part of the reason why Article 5 is so brief and doesn't lay out the procedures for a convention is because the majority of the delegates at the convention had attended a prior convention during that decade before. The reason this wasn't spelled out in the Constitution is the same reason innocent until proven guilty isn't spelled out in the Constitution, because it was clear historical practice and clear historical precedent to back it up. So I'd encourage this committee to consider that when determining the appropriateness of this legislation. The final point I just want to address is the question of why would amendments make any difference, right? Why should we be trying to amend the Constitution as opposed to just enforcing what's on the books right now? And this goes back to the point I made at the beginning, the question of the crisis of federalism that we face here today. It's a false dichotomy to say we need to enforce the Constitution, but we don't need Article 5. And the reason for that is because Article 5 is part of the Constitution. It is one of the key checks and balances. In fact, James Madison in 1830 said that it was the ultimate resort of the states within the purview of the Constitution. He wrote that in a letter to Edward Everett. That is why it's a false dichotomy, because in order to use the Constitution, you have to be willing to use every part of the Constitution, to use all of the checks and balances. And one of those checks, the only check remaining to defend the states that's in the text of the Constitution, is Article 5. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Representative Luker, if we can be brief.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kelly, you raised concerns about the 17th Amendment. You said the ratification process will protect us. What happened with the 17th Amendment, or even the 16th Amendment, for that matter, on income tax?
Mr. Kelly.
Certainly, and in each of those cases, those amendments were ratified by 3/4 of the several states. So it's not to say that an amendment that would later be disagreed with could be adopted. Certainly, it's possible that generations down the road could disagree with the amendments we adopt. But it is to say that any amendment that is adopted will be supported by the overwhelming majority of the American people today. Something like term limits, something like a balanced budget amendment, something like a restraint on Congress's power under the Commerce Clause.
Follow up.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Kelly, I guess I'm just getting back to your original point. You say the 17th Amendment was one of our downfalls, and yet the ratification process did not protect us from that. What's to stop that from happening again in a new convention?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Luker, I believe the protection there is, again, you can look at what the American people overwhelmingly support today, right? Those are the types of amendments that are going to get 3/4 ratification. So, yes, there was a time in our history where the Senate was incredibly corrupt. It was buying seats, essentially, from state legislators. State legislators were getting rich by essentially selling seats to the federal Congress. And it was overwhelmingly popular with the American people, the idea that senators should be directly elected to address that corruption. I think in hindsight, that was probably a mistake. But if you look at the types of amendments that enjoy the overwhelming support of the American people today, they are, again, things like a balanced budget amendment limiting the power of the federal government.
Thank you, Mr. Kelly. Representative Scott, the floor has started, and they are going to be voting on bills that they're starting.
I will be very short. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Mr. Kelly. My question is, we're talking about legislators and that getting rich from, you know, throughout this process. My question is, I've been very undecided on this, and I appreciate your testimony and your knowledge in this, but I was just got a convention of the states email asking citizens that they need to raise $125,000 within the next 2 days. My question is, what will convention of states do with this money from the citizens?
Sure. So every dollar that we raise gets reinvested back into the motion. We hold hundreds of events across the country. There are fees to run those events. I say roughly half of our events cost under $100 a piece, but we have literally thousands of events that we host across the country. We have 25 full-time staff members, myself included in that number, that we have to pay just in order to do the research, to be able to do the homework, to show up here to provide the testimony that we do. So all of that money is going to be invested back into the project. And I'm certainly happy to provide you any details of how we spend our finances, if you'd like that.